Hello, good morning and welcome. We have got Rob Hertzhoff, Jean van Niekerk, who's going to tell us about fraud, Gorky Kooiman and Jaki Celeer on the show today. Lots to do with the US elections. And I guess it's a good place to start. There was a lot of information from our partners at Bloomberg. Here's the latest news headlines.
Vice President Kamala Harris has conceded the race for the presidency.
A fundamental principle of American democracy is that when we lose an election, we accept the results. That principle, as much as any other, distinguishes democracy from monarchy or tyranny. And anyone who seeks the public trust must honor it.
We go to Detroit next, and Bloomberg's Romain Bostic, who tells us the blue wall crumbled not just for Kamala Harris, but for down-ballot Democrats as well.
Of the 13 House seats that the Michigan has in the U.S. Congress, seven of those seats will be held by Republicans. That will be the first majority that they have held on a House basis in quite some time.
That's Bloomberg's Romain Bostic speaking in Detroit. Meantime, Sarah Chamberlain, the president and CEO of the Republican Main Street Partnership, gives us her prediction on how Congress will operate.
We won't have the House and the Senate, but, you know, we're going to have it with members that still live in very swing purple districts. So you're going to have to compromise with them. I think president will put his agenda out there. We will have some discussions. We'll compromise. And then hopefully we'll get some good legislation passed for the country. I do think there will be a continuation of the tax cuts, maybe not as deep as people would like. But I think that you'll see that because they really, a lot of Republicans do feel that it will help the economy.
That is Sarah Chamberlain of the Republican Main Street Partnership. Financial markets mapped out Donald Trump's return to the White House, as well as the potential for Republicans to control both houses of Congress. Stocks hit all-time highs. We had the S&P higher by 2.5%. The Dow Industrial Average was up 3.6%, and the NASDAQ Composite gained 3%. One beneficiary of the so-called Trump trade, Tesla. Its shares rallied nearly 15% in the regular session. Here's Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow.
The calculation the market's making is that Tesla has scale, it has pricing power. And so in a world where those incentives were removed by the Trump administration in the new year or whenever it happens, Tesla could stand on its own 2 feet and sort of take advantage of that overall negative situation for the market.
That is Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow. Now, Donald Trump's victory is boosting an investment strategy favoring U.S. assets over international ones. Bloomberg's Bill Ferry says global leaders may be bracing for tougher trade policy under Trump 2.0.
I think he's going to use that threat of tariffs as leverage against a lot of countries, rivals and allies as well. So I don't know that we get a flat tariff across on all imports, but I think he's going to try to use that as a wedge against other countries to try to get them to buy more American goods or to compete more favorably on trade.
That is Bloomberg's Bill Ferries. On to the Federal Reserve. The central bank is expected to cut its key policy rate by a quarter point, and Chair Jay Powell will likely field a barrage of questions about Donald Trump's return to the White House and what it will mean for growth, inflation, and borrowing cost. Earlier in the year, Trump said he would not reappoint Powell if Trump were to return to the White House. We spoke with Libby Cantrell, the head of public policy at PIMCO. She told us it will be hard for Trump to fire Powell, although he will be able to affect significant changes across other regulatory agencies.
Some of these other independent agencies like the Fed, very unlikely he can fire Powell, for instance. But for the CFPB and the FHFA, he can usher change just given the structure of those agencies. So again, there will be a big change even just from a regulatory perspective. So even when we're not talking about legislation or spending or tax policy, what he can do unilaterally is going to be pretty significant.
That was Libby Cantrell, head of public policy at PIMCO. Trump's election victory has already led to a frantic repricing in financial markets around the world, so Powell will need to reassure global investors that the Fed can manage the impact of a second Trump term.
A repricing around the world? Well, it's interesting to see what is happening in South Africa. We're going the other way, or well, certainly we did yesterday. The shares on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange falling at a time that those elsewhere in the world were actually flying. But in the international markets on Wall Street, as we heard a little earlier that from our partners at Bloomberg, good moves for the stock market, but Bitcoin is really on fire, up another 9.75%. It's now sitting at $74,830. They love Trump. He's been described as a Bitcoin bro. Palantir, after a 25% jump yesterday, is up another 8.6% last night. Our time, NVIDIA, Amazon, the whole BizNews portfolio really just surging. What is interesting is the Russell 2000 ETF, and this is the index that marks small and medium listings on the American stock markets. That was up by 6%. So it suggests to you that Main Street thinks, or the investors think, that Main Street is going to benefit just as much from a Trump presidency. Here in South Africa, resources led the market lower, but there really wasn't much good news anywhere. Excepting for the Rand, which clawed back some of its recent losses. It was 18 cents stronger against the US dollar, 17.58, and 17 cents better against the pound at 22.72. But Murray and Roberts, after that awful trading update, to say that they are going to be scaled back in one of their major contracts with the Venetia diamond mine, this on the back of falling diamond demand around the world, that share price down, and it's already kind of in the trough, down another 16%. Sibanye lost a lot of what it picked up the day before, added, as did Implats and Anglo Platinum. And there's a 2.5% decline for MTN. Now, this is interesting in that MTN does have operations in Iran, and Iran is one of those areas that is likely to be fretting most from a Donald Trump presidency. Well, someone who's not fretting at all from that is Rob Hersov, and he joins us now. Rob, lovely to see you again, and thanks for being such a regular commentator on the BizNews briefing in the morning. You called Trump a while ago. So did R.W. Johnson. On the 8th of October, we ran a piece for BizNews Premium. R.W. said the data shows Trump is going to win. The mainstream media in America, and indeed here in South Africa, just would not believe it. There were seven states that determined or were going to always determine which way the presidency went. All of them went to Trump. So it's comprehensive.
Comprehensive indeed. It's not quite a landslide. I think a landslide is 60-40, the definition, but it's damn close. And I am thrilled. I think the world is in a much better place, and it would be even better if we can make South Africa great again. I called Trump at 285. He's going to probably go through 300. So, you know, I always disbelieve mainstream media in America. And once celebrities start endorsing someone, it's a surefire way for that person to lose. No one listens to celebrities or elites talking down to people. They look at the facts. And a lot of people don't like Donald's character, myself included. But you've got to look past him and look at his policies, what he intends to do, who are the people around him. And the fact is, he's been president already for 4 years before. He's had 4 years in the waiting room to stew, to think about what he could do better. And he's going to hit the ground running. He's actually going to hit the ground very quickly. He knows exactly the people he wants to put in place and exactly the policies he wants to implement. And he's got a seriously big mandate from the voters in America to implement those policies. So I'm very positive about the world, where the world is today. All we've got to do is get rid of Keir Starmer and the Labour Party in the UK, some lefty in Australia, I can't remember his name, and the dreadful Trudeau in Canada. And the Western civilization is back on the correct trajectory. Also, it would be nice to get rid of the ANC in this country, but we're going to talk about Trump's impact on South Africa in a second.
You've lived in America, you've studied in America, you've got a lot of American friends. You'd plugged in far better than most South Africans are to that country. Why this big swing to Trump?
So the people that I speak to are mainly investors, corporate chieftains, heads of institutions, business people. And every single one of them, publicly or quietly in private, said, we're backing Trump. You know, anyone who's from a communist or socialist country that lives in America now says we just cannot, we've seen socialism and communism, they don't work, they're destructive, they're evil, they kill people. And Kamala is closer to that socialist world than Trump. Trump is a business person. We need more business people in politics. I agree with that. You know, we're voting for Trump. A lot of people, actually, like Bill Ackman, who was a lifelong Democrat, went public and said, you know, I'm now backing Trump. I'm a Republican. But also very impressive, successful people like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and others, said, you know, on record, we're with Trump. And I follow those people. I think they're the smartest people of all, those business successes. And all of them back Trump. So it was the business, I'm not going to say elites, because I leave elites for the Democrats, but it was the business success stories, the workers, males, huge swing in blacks and Latinos to Trump, big swing in under 30s to Trump. And he deserves it. He deserves the victory. He's won the popular vote. He's won the Senate. He's won the House. He's got his mandate to get rid of woke, get rid of DEI, to get rid of ESG, to get rid of identity politics, to get rid of men competing in women's sports, and all of this rubbish that has come in via the left. And I think we're on track for a very, very good next 4 years.
For America. And the world and South Africa?
And the world.
South Africa?
Well, I think South Africa is irrelevant. I think, you know, Donald Trump is not particularly interested in Africa, and I doubt South Africa is even on his radar. But the fact is that our moronic ANC, because they're being bribed by the Iranians through MTN structures, trust me, I think our moronic ANC, you know, supporting the rogue states of Russia, China, and Iran, are going to get some tough medicine at some point from Trump, and deservedly so.
When you come back to South Africa, we were a non-aligned country, or certainly that's how we try to position ourselves. Can you see that positioning will now get accelerated in future?
You know, Cyril is spineless, but he's isolated, and you know, I think he is trying to do the right thing with the GNU, but the ANC is not a single voice. You've got communists in the ANC, you've got trade unionists in the ANC, you've got lunatics, incompetents, morons, you've got everyone, clowns, you've got the whole gang. And it's impossible now for Cyril to speak with one voice and represent what the ANC stands for and means. It doesn't stand for anything except corruption, incompetence, and taking money from whoever will give it to them. They're a bunch of prostitutes now. So, you know, on the international front, Iran cleared the ANC's debt. So the ANC is Iran's lapdog, and hence the ICJ court application against Israel. You know, and Iran says jump, and the ANC says how high. So for Cyril to swing his group of lunatics to a more centrist position is very difficult when the paymasters are Russia and Iran.
Sure. So what does that mean for South Africa, in your opinion? I know you have been investing in the Western Cape quite significantly, but the rest of South Africa, is it uninvestable again?
Well, it's not really investable. From an outside FDI perspective, I wouldn't bother looking at South Africa. The Western Cape, as a South African, is very investable. If the GNU survives, the Western Cape will continue to boom. If the GNU collapses, semigration will go through the roof, and the Western Cape will continue to boom. And it's being run well by the DA. So the sooner Gauteng voters wake up and realize that they've got, you know, the lunatics at the helm, the ANC, and get rid of them, the Gauteng is never going to get fixed. The DA needs a clear majority. There needs to be over 50% to fix Gauteng. Otherwise, they're not going to bother even taking on a coalition to run Gauteng. And I think they're right. So is South Africa investable for FDI? Still not, no.
There was an interesting...
The GNU, so...
There was an interesting gathering at the Voortrekker Monument recently, where Gaydon McKenzie, who you've been a big supporter of, had quite a big impact. This is all against the Bella Bill. Why would Gaydon position himself against the Bella Bill so publicly in a at an event where there were many people, thousands of people?
Gaydon does the right thing in each and every circumstance. He was born speaking Afrikaans in some small town in the Free State near Bloemfontein. And he believes that Afrikaans, the language, the culture, is very much part of the fabric of South Africa and cannot be marginalized or minimalized. And he said so. You know, he stands on principle. He stands for Israel. Correct. He stands for Afrikaans, the language and the culture. Correct. He stands for equal opportunity, but not equal result. Correct. He's on the money. Gaydon is a man of principle. And in the cases where he thinks Cyril is doing the right thing, which to me are very rare occasions, he stands with Cyril. Correct. So Gaydon is a man of principles, a man of values, and he's doing the right thing in each and every case. I stand with him. And you know, he went there to show that he believed the Bella Bill is a bad bill and is trying to, in a cruel and unfair way, marginalize the Afrikaans language and Afrikaans culture. So he stood against it, as do I.
Rob Hersoff, global entrepreneur. Before you go, Gaydon's Patriotic Alliance has come from nowhere to 2% of the national vote. Franz Grenier, I think, was suggesting that they'd go up to 4% if the election was held today. You're looking at 6 now. It certainly is a party on the move. They won a by-election recently, which I guess is pointing in the right direction. Where's your prediction for where the PA, Patriotic Alliance, will end up?
So on a national basis, it's trending to 10%. I think in the municipals, which is a great indication of, you know, competence. People look for competence in their municipals because they want to have their roads and towns and villages and fixed and things working. I think he will, the Patriotic Alliance will do extremely well. So I think they'll 6 to 10% in the municipals and be at 10% by the nationals.
Going to be an interesting development as we go forward. Rob Hersoff, global entrepreneur, bringing us his views on the Donald Trump victory in the United States. We now pick up with Jean van Niekerk. He's the convener for the Forensic Standing Committee at ACISA. Jean, is that your full-time job?
Not necessarily, Alec. I'm full-time employed within the banking sector, looking after investments and insurance. But I do dedicate quite a bit of my time to insurance and investments industry initiatives.
Okay, so that's what ACISA is about. It brings together, it's kind of an umbrella body for banks, insurance companies, investment organizations, so that we can, you can understand exactly where the country is going.
Absolutely.
Just from a little bit of background on this, the fraud that you guys look at went up significantly in the past year. You've this week brought out your numbers to show that it was nearly 50% up on last year. But something that caught my eye immediately was that you've now uncovered murders, and there were 14 of them, where people were trying to get life insurance payouts. This seems to be a new trend in South Africa.
Absolutely, Alec. So to give some context, we embarked on a revamp of our statistics and how we gather these statistics annually. The first round of this was in 2022. We subsequently included categories where we want to look at hotspots or high-priority crimes, and this includes the murder for money, and it of course includes the deceased estate frauds. So what we're trying to do is to draw some statistical trends, if you will, based on what we see within the industry to enable our industry to better respond and to, of course, understand the magnitude of what the problem truly is.
And it does appear that you've managed to uncover some of these. Just give us some color on that. Why do people, or who has done this, and maybe you can give us an example or two of where you've uncovered where people have actually killed others. I suppose for most of us, we would think, well, it's a husband killing a wife to try and get the insurance money. We see that on the movies. But in real life, how does this all play out?
So, Alec, I would say there's a few combinations of factors. What we've, of course, seen in the media more recently is the abuse of the insurable interest elements. What this really means is what you've alluded to earlier. We do often see family members insuring family members and subsequently murdering them for the insurance payouts. And this, of course, is quite concerning because it plays on the factors and the principles of life insurance, which means that you must have some form of insurable interest on the life that you're insuring.
Just explain that.
So insurable interest would dictate that in order to insure anything, whether you're talking about general insurance, whether you're talking about life insurance, you inherently need an interest within that item or that life that you're insuring. So think of your vehicle. You may not insure your neighbor's vehicle. You don't have an interest in insuring that vehicle. That would be seen as enrichment. Similarly, in the life insurance industry, policies and contracts very often have guidelines around which and what is insurable interest and what you're allowed to insure. Think of it in the sense of spouses, direct family, potentially extended family. And in extreme circumstances or the more business-sense circumstances, you would think of business keyman insurance, where co-directors in a company, for example, may insure each other. Again, there's a vested interest amongst the parties. And of course, the breadwinners are often the ones that are being insured so that there's sustainability in the case of a bereavement. What I'm alluding to, unfortunately, and we've seen it in the media cases such as the Rosemary and Lovers and the much more recent Limpopo matter, is these individuals have gone as far as insuring their direct family members, meaning they have a vested interest in the individual they're insuring. And unfortunately, they then abuse that contractual element to murder these individuals for those proceeds. It's not to say we don't see more extreme cases where vulnerable individuals may be abused, such as destitute individuals. But the more prominent features that we continue to see is where there's a direct familial connection or relationship.
Yeah, I remember many years ago, somebody who our family knew, together with others, had taken an individual, a destitute person, a homeless person, put them in a car, burnt the car, killed the person, obviously, put them in a car, burnt the car, and then claimed the insurance money. But I thought that had made headlines, and I thought that was a very isolated example. But clearly, from what you're saying now, it isn't. However, the big thing here is the increase in the numbers. If fraud is going up 50%, how can we, or what is being done about it? And I ask you this in the context of what we've been reporting on in the past week, this organization called Bankso. Last Friday, we had Claire, who came on the program, told us her story. But the worst about all of this was Bankso was suspended from trading by the Financial Services Conduct Authority a couple of weeks before they hooked her and stole 700 or 800,000 rand, her life savings, from her. You would just think that perhaps it's time for some examples to be made for a, and the Bankso is operating in Cape Town. She went into their offices for the cops to arrive there, haul people off, maybe get some of the news channels to have cameras to show all of this. Because it seems at the moment, if you can operate with impunity as these fellows did, something's going wrong here, Sean.
So, Alec, on your first part of the question, I think it's important to also highlight where we've seen the volumes of fraud, and this is specific to the life and investments industry, where we've seen the volumes increase. It was primarily under the remuneration fraud categories. You'd note that we've seen about 2,800 or just above 2,800 cases more coming in year on year. That means the remainder of the increase of about 1,400 cases is evenly distributed between application fraud, fraudulent claims, and of course the withdrawals and disinvestments fraud. Now, whilst the remuneration fraud is increasing in numbers, what we're definitely seeing is that the preventions, that the preventions have increased year on year. So that for us is a positive spin or a positive move where the losses are being managed within the appetite that the industry has to manage it and that the preventions are increasing. Now, on the converse, however, if we're looking at application fraud, the story that that's telling us at the moment, an application fraud for some context would be where an individual applies for a product, They may be misrepresenting themselves, they may be providing false information, or it may be identity theft outright. And what we continue to see there is a certain increase in the amount that the industry is preventing. Now, converse to that, we have seen a slight reduction in the losses year on year, but importantly, the number of events have reduced with these corresponding figures. That tells us that the attack rate may be reducing, but the average ticket value, if you will, is increasing. Now, the same can be said for things like insurance claims. Again, there we've seen roughly from 2,600 cases up to 4,100. And again, the average ticket values do appear to be increasing, which means that the attacks are becoming more sophisticated. They're being more focused on higher value ticket items or insurance policies or investments. And to that effect, you know, it's something that the industry continues to grapple with, and of course, deploying new technologies, new mechanisms to try and detect, prevent, and ultimately manage these risks. You've asked what the industry is doing. You've alluded to the case, and I've read up on this case that you've referenced earlier this week. The industry, from an insurance and investments perspective, is continuously evolving their mechanisms. And what I'm alluding to is things like biometric authentication. We know that within the world that we live in, 2024, the high rate of digitalization, as well as looking at the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, we've seen an increase in data breaches, right?
Yeah, Sean, thanks, man. I think we're really going over ground that we know about. I was asking you about banks, though, in particular. Do you have any issue over banks, though, or any relevance over it? Can you not do something about these people who are going in and stealing from the public?
So Bankso specifically, I believe they're a trading company, Alec. So I'm aware that the FSCA has been looking into them. The license was suspended. However, from a direct element, we look at linked investment services companies and we looked at collective investment services companies, which means that the traders don't necessarily fall within our ambit.
Okay.
I've recently started following the case, but I think it's an interesting use case that must be looked at in the sense of the response that you've referenced, right? Specifically from a law enforcement perspective.
John van Niekerk is with a CISA, and that just emphasizes again, you've got kind of two groupings. Here's the organized financial institutions who are able to reduce the amount of crime that is perpetrated on them. They find the murderers. They get hold of the scoundrels who are playing around in deceased estates and so on. Although I'll tell you one thing in there, in the data that came up, was there were 8,000 incidents of agents of insurance companies and call centers who were actually trying to make commission that they weren't entitled to. Eish, I'll tell you what, it is a tough world out there. You've just got to be educated and keep your wits and your eyes and ears about you. Corky Koyman is with us now. He is from Denker Capital. Good to have you with us, Corky. And thanks for the little photo bombing earlier. I was delighted to see that you're with us, but none of your issue. It's a big day for investments, a big day for financial services stocks, the area that you are the expert on and our go-to guy. Can we start with America? How did the financial shares react to the Trump victory?
Well, I suppose the word to use is exploded. The regional banks and some of the most of the investment banks gained 11%. The range was between 8% to 14%. I think Goldman Sachs was up the most, 13%. J.P. Morgan up 13%. Bank of America up 9%. So the range is between 8% and 13%. And bear in mind, I just look now, something like most regional banks are already up 60 to 70%, well, including this year to date or for the 12 months. So we've already had quite a good move. But on top of this, you now got 14%, 13% in one day. So what triggered this? Well, obviously the Trump election and victory, but it's the policies that the market is anticipating that he might push through. And so we're talking specifically tariff protection against exports, in other words, America first, but tariff protection is inflationary. So if you load imports with tariffs, it means your consumers have to pay more for the products. So that's inflation. So you see your long bond yield has jumped to 4.4%. Now, that a few months ago was 3.7. That's a 70 basis point rise in 10-year interest rates in America, anticipating higher inflation. But the important thing for banks as well is that Trump is very anti-regulation, less protection, and the market anticipates that he will reverse some of the protection, some of the regulation to make doing business easier, to facilitate business. And specifically on the banks, the threat was, well, it actually was happening. The process was that banks were going to be loaded with higher Basel III capital requirements. Fortunately, that has not been finalized yet. And so the anticipation is that's an easy one, win for Trump. He can immediately say, just cancel that whole project. So it's not regulation has to be reversed in this case. In this case, it just says cancel it. And so the threat was hanging over the banks that they're going to have to deal with more capital requirements, and that's been removed, and hence the big. The other one, obviously, is very America first, and less regulations means more growth. Just by the way, a quick interesting stat, the European Union gross domestic product, you know, the size of the economy and the U.S. economy were almost the same at the end of 2008. U.S. is now 70% bigger in terms of its GDP than Europe. And that is how many years later? That is 16 years later. But over the 16 years, U.S. has grown 70% more than Europe. And the answer is really regulation. Europe has tried to regulate, protect everybody, look after everybody. And that's what this election was about. Trump wants to grow. Democrats wanted to protect people, give handouts, which is, you've got to look after the poor. But okay, back to the banks. So the banks have had a good rally. So the question now is, obviously this is anticipation of what he could do. If, let's say, he comes with policies that he actually reverses some of the legislation, you could have a further run. Yeah, because obviously that increases profitability more. If there's huge backlash and he can't push through what he wants to push through, then the movement's been a bit of an overreaction. But in essence, I'm sure Jamie Dimon and his colleagues clinked a few glasses of champagne last night, because we've entered an era which will be better for banks than under a Harris election.
You mentioned Jamie Dimon. He was being tipped as the Treasury Secretary for Harris, and he even said he was up for the job for Harris. Presumably, he's not going to get that job with Trump.
No, that will now go to the boyke from Pretoria, Elon Musk. No, by the way, Elon has done wonderfully well in getting him into a position. And if you're a capitalist and you have your president influenced by a guy like Elon, you know, then that's good for growth. Jamie Dimon, in that regard, I'm just not sure. I think the divide between his thinking and Trump's thinking. But Jamie Dimon is pragmatic. And if Trump was to ask him, do you want to come and play a role? I mean, it'd be stupid to say no, because as a very experienced, the most experienced bank CEO, he could have a huge influence and temper Trump and steer the direction. But it could be that he decides, listen, the guy isn't going to listen to me. I can't handle the individual that he, yeah.
Well, when we spoke ahead of the election to Anthony Ginsberg of Gins Global, he was saying that he was hoping that Trump would win so that it could release a number of acquisitions that had been were on the cards or on the table, but are being blocked by the mergers and acquisitions SAR, for want of a better word, the antitrust people in Washington. With the banks, is it something similar? Are there mergers and acquisitions that were on the table, but that the Democrat appointed boss of saying whether you can the thumbs up or thumbs down was actually stopping them?
Yeah. So one of the strongest price moves yesterday was Capital One, Bank Capital One. It's actually headquartered in Washington. It went up 15%. And that is because Discover, it's in a credit card company in the US, a large one, had made a bid for Capital One, and that was being blocked. And so obviously now the thinking of the market is with the Trump administration that that will be removed and they will get the go-ahead. So Discover jumped 15% on the increased possibility that they will be bought out. And you'll find more of that of the regional banks as well. There are just still too many banks in the US, and a lot of the mergers that were logical were blocked until, as you remember, when we had the whole Silicon Valley issue where then the banks that were in trouble were allowed to be bought out. But for the rest, the regulators were blocking it because of Democrat pressure that this is, well, in the end, it gives more power. In the end, it possibly labor loses jobs. And, they were very anti things that would be pro-capital and stimulate growth.
It really at the core of what the Americans have done from reading what you're saying is they have chosen to move away from this process of protecting people or protection to one where the individual must now look after themselves. Is that a little harsh?
I think if you're in the simplest form, you've described it perfectly. It is actually taking protection away or being less protectionist. And there are people who will get hurt. At the end of 2008, the guy said, we can put a robot on every street lights, on every street corner, but you'll slow down the traffic. But that's not practical. So people have got to drive and stop when there's a stop street and not expect the people from the other side not to cross. So the Democrats were trying to just protect, overprotect. And you can see that in Europe, where the growth rate remains so low because there is just so much red tape to get business done. And I think it's a huge lesson for South Africa as well that, and we have got parts of society that need protection, need help, but you must actually let the private sector to do more of that and then rather curb the private sector that your monopolistic situations don't become too strong or they can't use that power.
So curb the excesses, but allow freedom, allow people to, I suppose, or businesses to express themselves. We in our country have been performing a lot worse than the American economy. We only 0.35% now of global GDP, yep, which is pretty much nothing. Is there any sign that South Africa will be turning around? Certainly we have the GNU, the Government of National Unity, yep, and you check the numbers very carefully from the South African banks on credit extension, etc. Are there any green shoots?
There are a lot of green shoots, and you can see the market has been reacting to that. But the main risk, well, the green shoots we can already see in transit, in Portnet, in even Eskom. The fact that we haven't had load shedding, people have forgotten what load shedding was. The visa application process, but I think the biggest risk, just talking this week again to a lot of the role players and people very involved, is unfortunately the system in which we operate is still highly corrupt and incentives drive that corruption. And so unless you really have a massive, I would say number one effort must be to bring back control in that regard, and adequate quality people who can exercise control, who can ensure that when you put out a tender, that the tender does go to the best tender application. So that is the biggest risk. The murders we've recently seen, the gang murders in George and here in Cape Town, it testifies to the fact that there's an infiltrated mafia who actually plays a large role in South Africa, and we cannot allow that to take over in South Africa. So that's the dark side, and it is still there, and everywhere I hear people are saying it's going to be very difficult to control. It's up to the president to actually give the the hawks and the police the powers to really curb the dark side of South Africa that could retard us.
We had a horrific story yesterday where Chris Stein interviewed a member, one of, I think it's only two MPs from the Coloured Congress Party, who went along to a jail and met with a policeman who had been incarcerated for 4.5 years because he refused an order from one of these CADA deployed generals to go and arrest a mayor. He said, that's not my job to arrest people without trial. And so he was the one thrown into jail. And what amazes me is nothing's happened. He's still in jail today, this morning.
Yeah.
And I've heard, and he's the politicians on the police portfolio committee. So he's busy, no doubt, stirring things up there. But we do have a new police minister who has a good record in water. It just seems perhaps that the task is so huge that even a most obvious sore thumb like this person who's sitting in jail unfairly is not even being addressed.
So you're totally right. The new Minister of Police has made a huge change. You can see the number of arrests, even the number of shootings where criminals get arrested and shot when they flee. So the incidence of positive cases has increased dramatically, but the system still needs a revamp. You've got, it's almost like taking over, think of Manchester United, the new coach, he's inherited those players. Okay, now he's got to start changing the squad. And I'm not sure that the president, our president, wants to change the squad because the squad has got their hands in the till and don't want to let go enough. And so that's really, but you're totally right. The initial changes were very good. The real thing is we need to build on that momentum, and the president's got to, this is his chance to really step in and remove the bad apples and have them prosecuted and allow for better people to come in.
Corky, you're always very measured, so to hear you talking like this is a little surprising for me. Is this the feedback that you're getting from people in the international community and indeed from big business in South Africa?
It's actually both. I've had a few discussions actually yesterday and the day before, and I don't want to reveal the names, that actually just I'm by nature optimistic, and I've actually been very positive, and it's worked so far in terms of the direction we've taken. But the warnings were just don't get too optimistic. There is a huge legacy that has to be broken down. And the case that you referred to is a classical one that you hear so much, that people who want to do well in the civil service just don't get promoted. If you're a policeman who wants to go and arrest a gangster, but your sergeant or your captain above you is also in on the pay, then you know you get sidelined. You don't get promotion. So you want that whole system to back to my Manchester United example. You want the coach to get players who want to go and attack, who want to play. At the moment, we got people in a lot of the agencies who don't want to play, who rather want to protect the criminals. It's actually, yeah, this is the most negative you've seen me for a while.
Indeed.
But that is just what I've been hearing the last few days, that the moves have been good, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. So your question is, are we going to grow faster? We need a lot more to be done. And make no mistake, the changes that have been made and that will still follow will obviously create growth. It will create more pressure to do the right things. But we've got to pursue that. And in terms of the international community, we can see more and more that foreign businessmen and bankers are coming here to look at the situation, to decide whether to invest capital. And if we go back all the way to post P.W. Botha's Rubicon speech, when we had the FinRand and the ComRand because money was leaving the country, what really turned us then is, you know, when F.W. de Klerk started the change and capital came back. Mm. And a country needs capital to grow, and specifically South Africa. We've been capital starved. So it's very important that we say to these the foreign bankers, come and invest with us. This is what we're doing, and show them what we're doing. But they must, at the moment, they're still saying we want to see the policies come through. We want to see evidence.
Corky Kooyman with Denker Capital giving us some very useful insights there on exactly where South Africa stands in the world. You wouldn't want to do that analysis of how South Africa has performed since 2008. You really wouldn't want to, because we have flatlined pretty much from that period. That's going on for nearly 15 years now. Sorry, more, 16 years. And on the other hand, the rest of the world, especially the United States, has been powering ahead. If that's not a strong support for freedom, freeing people up, because only when the economy grows, only when wealth is created, can it be distributed, then I really don't know. But, well, we keep listening, we keep sharing ideas, and the world is changing, and it's changing very rapidly. Chris Steyn, my colleague, knows just how much the world is changing. And yesterday, she had an interview with the mayor, the new mayor of Tshwane, Mayor Moya. Let's watch, listen in.
Hope for the long-suffering residents of the capital.
I think firstly is to say the residents, I know that it looks bad, especially after the lead up to the motion. It was terrible. The anxiety that we as politicians caused, it's unforgivable. But then after the motion, at least it was an issue of transition and make sure that, you know, services continue. But I think the images coming out of council on Thursday, they don't look good for us, because we've said we will give you stability. The next thing, our colleagues, you know, they appear to have been drained out of council, and residents are asking, is this your idea of stability? But I think what is important for me is to say we will work this out. We've got our own issues inside the council chambers, but those issues cannot translate into lack of service delivery. Services will come to them. We'll do the best that we can to make sure that we continue to serve the residents of Tshwane. That I'm not saying they must ignore what happens in council, but we will sort it out. We are all leaders in council. We are all representing the residents of Tshwane. So we will find each other and act that way. But for the residents, they have our commitment in terms of the services coming to them and us trying to find solutions. You will see us all over the place. For me, I'm not even ashamed of begging. Like, MEC, can I have just 5 minutes of your time? And then I go there. Because we need to find creative solutions on how we serve the residents. And that, from my side, that will happen. But we'll talk to the residents of Tshwane. We're not going to tweet them. We'll talk to them. We'll meet with leaders of society in Tshwane. We have started. We've met with business. We've met with labor. We've met, you know, with the taxi industry. So we're going to meet with the leaders of society in Tshwane. So it's not that this, you know, this government is close to the people. And one of the things that I've been getting from, I don't know how to describe, it's been residents that I've dealt with before, even when I was a chief of staff, and say, yeah, does this mean you're only going to serve the townships? I'm like, no, that's not what I said. I said equitable services, service delivery in the city. That's what I said. I didn't say I'm going to only serve the townships. And I think what is important, though, is just to understand our vision and where these stakeholders fit into that vision. And also for them to tell us their vision. And for instance, the issue of the AfriForum MOU. Why should we single out AfriForum? We don't want to work with you. They're equally residents of the city. But we're going to engage with them. We've reached out. I've reached out and said, listen, can we talk? Discomforts here and there, can we talk about them and not tweet each other? Sometimes we think tweeting is communication, but no, let's meet, let's talk about what the discomforts, what is it that we would like to see happen? What is it that you want to see happen? And then we take from there. So from my side personally, I'm not here to divide the city. I'm here to unite the city. And that's my commitment. So the work will continue. We will have challenges, but it's how we respond to those challenges that I think will count for residents to forgive us for our mistakes.
Well, the Action SA mayor, recently appointed mayor of Tshwane, she's got her hands full. Oh, she talks a good game. Yaki Salia joins us now. He's the founder of the Institute of Security Studies. Yaki, good to have you on the day after Donald Trump's ascension to the throne. The emperor is back. I saw this guy in Davos and he really he walked in like an emperor. But the people in Davos, the global leaders and the globalists, I suppose, as they're being denigrated by now, were all, you could hear a pin drop. They were asking him questions. Yeah. Nobody was booing him. So the guy's got a presence, and certainly he's got a following. Were you surprised by the extent of his victory, though?
Alec, I was. Probably like many people, I was hoping against hope that he would not win, although the polling results were showing the opposite. So, yes, a bit of a shock. And a concerning one, I think, globally in certain ways, because he brings a significant amount of disruption to the global environment. And that unpredictability and lack of, predictability is really, really a concern.
What about Africa to start with? The ISS operates all over the continent. Well, you operate globally, but you're experts in Africa. We'll talk about South Africa in just a moment. But how would Africa be viewing this victory by Trump?
Well, what has been happening is that Africa has been steadily moving down the priority list with the competition with China and so on. So this is another negative for Africa. I think, you know, the Americans have been, I think the one thing that will remain is the competition with China in Africa. But whereas Biden and others were building the Lobito Corridor and trying to partner with Africa, there was the Africa Leadership Summit and all of those things. I'm not sure that we are going to see much of that with Biden. It's going to be all out for himself. All out for himself, and the transactional politics that we've seen, I think, is once again going to come back. So a variety of things that I think will negatively impact Africa. I mean, there is, for example, are we going to see another U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit? What is going to happen with AGOA? What is going to happen with the Presidential Advisory Council of Doing Business in Africa that Biden established, the Millennium Challenge Account Corporation, Millennium Challenge Corporation has engaged in a number of so-called compacts with Africa. What's going to happen with that? And I think the most important is the potential reform of the World Bank and the IMF, unlocking more cheaper financing for Africa. I think that I'm not sure that that's on the cards at all now. And then, of course, there's the climate change implications. He's probably going to withdraw from Paris again, and this is all I think bad news for Africa.
So, first level thinking, it's more freedom for America. The economy might grow faster. They are going to improve their debt. But second-level thinking says, whoa, watch out, world. It's going to be a different man in the hot seat in the world's superpower.
Yes. I think that, you know, Trump may in the short term do the U.S. good, but in the long term, what this does is, in my view, it accelerates the U.S. decline because the kind of bigger thy neighbor kind of politics that he excels in, I think is generally just not good for the world. It's because it's this competitive kind of transactional politics, which I think does not do anybody well.
Transactional meaning I'll do this for you if you do that for me, and conditionality, I suppose, from a perspective that the International Monetary Fund used to insist that countries that borrowed from it, I think it still insists, have to follow a particular path. Is that what you mean by transactional?
Yeah, exactly. Transaction is there's no principle really involved. It's all a deal. It's based on the sort of kind of business background that Trump comes from. It's a deal. It's got nothing to do with sort of a common good, because the difference with Trump and with all other American politicians, I think, that we've dealt with is that he considers everything in that kind of way of what do I get out of this? And he's, in that sense, has only one interest, and that was very evident with his previous presidency, and that is for Trump himself. And now you're going to find, particularly with somebody like Elon Musk, also in the game, that the power of money, the power of corporations, the unfettered free engagement in making money is going to upend the importance of democracy and accountability and good governance from an American perspective. I think it is quite worrying.
What about the future for Africa with the relationships with China? And here I'd like to come back to our country, to South Africa. South Africa is a member of BRICS. BRICS now includes Iran. Trump does not like Iran. China, he's been saber-rattling with them. He seems to be okay as far as Putin is concerned with Russia, whereas the rest of the world doesn't seem, or the Western world doesn't seem to like Russia too much. How are you seeing all of these moving parts affecting us here?
I think the most dangerous thing for South Africa is that it's going to be perceived potentially as being anti-Israel because of what's happened, of course, around the court cases and everything and the evidence that's been brought. And that that the result could do us quite a bit of damage in terms of AGOA and trade and so on and so forth. So the fact that we are seen to be hostile towards Israel I think could really go down quite badly for South Africa in the short term. Because it's a question of he is unequivocally in support of what Israel is doing and how Israel is acting, and South Africa may end up as collateral damage in that process.
You mentioned AGOA. Unpack that for us and why this is now at risk.
Well, you know, AGOA is a unilateral trade concession, as you know, towards African countries, where African countries can trade freely. Their goods can come freely into the U.S. And, of course, for the U.S., trade with Africa is quite limited. It's been going down. It's largely around South Africa and one or two other countries. And Trump is all about tariffs. It's all about increasing the cost of external countries bringing their goods into the U.S. And I think that I'm not sure that it's important enough for Trump, he is about not providing any favors to anybody else except to himself, to his business associates. So I think AGOA may end up as also being collateral damage for Africa, with quite important ramifications. So I am concerned about that down the line. AGOA may also suffer.
How important is it, though? How relevant is it? How many South African jobs are on the line if this country does not have duty-free access into the United States?
I'm not sure about the I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the U.S. remains, particularly for our vehicle exports, quite important for South Africa. It's, the big challenge for South Africa is to be able to export manufactured goods. The U.S. provides duty-free access to that. I think that what this does, it just penalizes further, potentially, our exports. So it could have quite a negative impact on South Africa, particularly in the vehicle export market.
Yaki Selea is the founder of the Institute for Security Studies, and I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com. Well, we have had both sides of the story there. Rob Herzog delighted with Donald Trump's victory in the election. Yaki Selea giving us a huge dollop of wait, but. And where this all goes to from here is going to determine where South Africa's future is. We do know that we're living in a world where you've got to think more than just the obvious. And Donald Trump in America is going to accelerate that kind of process. Yesterday on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, South African stocks, particularly resources stocks, came under a lot of pressure once it was acknowledged that Donald Trump would win the election. Much smarter people than me will be able to have that answer, or at least put something together on the answer. But markets tell you the way that money is moving. And the obvious immediate presumption on that is that markets are saying if Donald Trump brings in tariffs, that's not going to be good for global economic growth. And global economic growth, if that's down, is not good for resources. Leaving aside the whole thing with AGOA, which at the moment gives South Africa duty-free access into the United States, if that were to be removed at the same time that Trump pushes up tariffs, well, South African exporters who currently are sending in products to the US won't be able to do that again. Crazy world we're living in. Things are changing all the time. Well, thank you for being with us today for the Hour of Power here on BizNews Briefing. We'll be back again, same time, same place tomorrow, which means 7 a.m. live streaming through Iono and YouTube. Until then, from the team, cheerio.